In this interview, I talked to Law Saberin, who is a US-based trad climber. They've done multiple 513 hard trad ascents, some of them quite scary, and have also made a recent repeat of the 514 trad route, East Coast Fist Bump. Law is also a non-binary climber, and we touch upon this in the interview today, which brings about many interesting discussion points. We also talk about the mental game in climbing. Law is a training or coaching specialist in this area and works with the Warrior's Way. And there's so many interesting messages and take homes that we had from this interview in this area. So I hope you enjoyed this one. I certainly did. And don't forget, this podcast is available both in video format. And also, if you're watching in video format now, it's available on our podcast. So thanks very much for joining us in this interview on our podcast and YouTube, Law. It's an absolute pleasure to get you here UK time this evening. I know it's going to be a little bit earlier for you because you're over in the US. What time is it now?
It's like 1 PM here.
Ah, so right in the middle of the day, plenty planned.
Yeah, we're right in the middle. Sorry?
Plenty planned for the day then, you got?
Yeah, I've got plenty of time. I think I'm coaching the youth team this afternoon, so it's a nice little break in the middle of the day.
Ah, awesome. Yeah. So to give everyone who's watching and listening just a bit of context as to why I invited Law onto the interview and the podcast and wanted to chat to Law about all, we're going to go through all sorts of different areas here, is that I think I first came across you, can't remember what it was, maybe like 2 or 3 years ago or so, and you were either trying or you'd repeated this really gnarly off-width route, crack route in Sedona called Mechanical Bull. And the thing that really stood out to me about this whole thing, and like I paid general attention to social media and whatnot, is that it was a repeat of a Kirkpatrick Kingsbury route. And he is like a pretty underground, but kind of quite hardcore crack climber off with her. And there you were, just, I like barely knew your name. I had no recognition as you as a climber, and you're just wading in on this like pretty hard route. And it sounded or felt like you're really going for it and fully committed to this process of doing something really hard. And I was like, who is Law? I need to know. Who's this person who's like totally into crack climbing and pushing themselves right at the limit and everything like that? And that's how I sort of first came across you, was, yeah, like a proper crack climbing obsessive, and someone that was prepared to push themselves hard on trad routes. Would you say that was did I cotton onto the right thing? Would you have considered yourself at the time a hardcore trad climber obsessive, or do you think I just saw one part of you as a climber?
I think that's pretty accurate. You know, something that's interesting about that route in particular, I already loved crack climbing and I was super stoked on all the sizes, except I had no off-width experience really. And I went out, I really wanted to learn, and someone suggested, they said like, oh, Pat is working on this off-width climb. He's amazing at off-width climbing. You should hit him up and see if you can just go belay him and learn something. And so I actually, the Mechanical Bull was not the first off-width climb that I sent, but it was the first off-width climb that I projected. So I started that one and then realized that I needed to take about 15 steps back and learn a lot of skills. So yeah, I was definitely pretty stoked and pretty willing to put the work in right away.
Okay, yeah, because I remember when I think I was on a trip to the US, possibly, I'm going to get vague on the timescales here, but maybe a year later or something. And then I just randomly met up with you in a bar in Las Vegas. And I'd been out climbing for the day, I think with Mary Eden, possibly, if my memory serves me right. And Mary had said that you were going to be at the bar and you were part of the group, or maybe I'd been messaging you on Instagram And I was like, this is going to be amazing. We're going to chat about all things, you know, crack climbing and off with thee. And what I think is interesting since, like, you know, obviously I met up and we chatted about all sorts of stuff, was that actually since then, I've actually become more aware of you as a climber and your, I guess your kind of your personal interest to me as a coach and another climber is actually your mental game. And I consider you as a real kind of one percenter in terms of the way you've changed and adapted your mental game to climbing, like a mental Jedi. You've really kind of learned your process. You know, now do it as a full-time job. And you work as a mental training coach. And I think this is the thing that is really fascinating in particular about you, not only like a hard climber and ticking hard stuff, but also this mental side of things as well.
Yeah, that's a huge part of my process. You know, I think I was actually someone from the very beginning in climbing, I was terrified. Like I was that kid, the very first time I climbed, that someone had to go to the top of the wall and like kind of coach me off to like help me let go. And it took about an hour to get me to let go of the wall. And that followed me like every step of the way in climbing. From, you know, my first time lead climbing, it took me about a year to take a lead fall. And, you know, there was a lot of, I guess, you know, there's a lot of, when I was younger, I felt like it was a part of my identity. It's maybe the best way to put it. I felt like I was just that scared kid on the wall. And as I got older, it became a part of my identity that I used a process to deal with it and to work through it. And I think, you know, you take that far enough and it's just like physical training. You know, if you're really bad at something and you start training it early on, but then you consistently train it for a really long time, all of a sudden you get pretty adept at it. You know, it's like you can't do one pull-up, so you practice pull-ups for 10 years and then all of a sudden you can do gnarly weighted pull-ups because you just kept working on them. And I think that was kind of mental training for me. It was, I invested in it originally just so that I could enjoy rock climbing again. And then it ended up being something that I applied to harder routes, to scary routes, and just things that I felt really motivated to keep pushing that area in.
Yeah, that's super interesting because you're obviously very good at that now and you've become adept at it. You've learned your process and you also have that job in coaching others with it. But yet you say that initially that was a really difficult thing for you and you weren't, you know, one of these natural kids that down the wall was just going for it on anything and never seemed to have any fear. It sounds like you were almost the opposite and that was definitely a very, very challenging part of climbing for you, if not maybe the most challenging part. I don't know.
Probably. I mean, at the time, I wasn't pushing myself physically to know even what my other weaknesses were at that point, because I just wouldn't get on routes that I thought I might fall on. So it was definitely my biggest weakness at that point in my climbing.
And what do you think have been the sort of the key, I suppose, both milestones and processes that you've gone through over that transition from where you were when you were younger to where you've got to in recent years? Because I suspect you still consider yourself as very much in the process and not you know, the enlightenment part of your mental game.
Yeah, definitely not. I mean, I think the first, like learning to fall, obviously, and learning a process for engaging falling and the fear of falling was huge for me. I also think that I had to change a lot about how I interacted with myself, with my thoughts, and what was coming up for me on a climbing day. And that still comes in, you know, I think some of, like this fall, I worked on a really big project, and I think the biggest thing I had to deal with in that situation was learning like really good self-compassion and self-care that allowed me to put in the amount of work that I had to, because I was really used to just like grinding in and like use it, like, you know, just like getting myself exhausted and like beating myself up, and it was not working. And so I had to shift that, you know. So there's, it's like every project for me, I find I have to tweak things just a little bit. So, but overall, it's just been a shift to be way more curious about things like that. Mm-hmm. And not see it as, you know, I think it's really easy to see mental training as an all or nothing thing. And I like that you use the word milestones, because it shows that kind of step-by-step progression the same way that you get physically stronger. It's like, you know, maybe one day you just learn to trust your partner taking, and you're like enjoying that, and you start laughing because, you know, for a long time, I didn't trust my climbing partners to take for me on the wall. I just thought they were going to like drop me to the ground if I said take or something. It was like an image in my head. So I would down climb every route. I was at a pretty basic level there, you know, of needing mental training. And so that was all I did for a while, was just get used to being able to sit in the rope. And then at a certain point, got used to taking small top rope falls, and then longer top rope falls, and then lead falls. And all of mental training has kind of mirrored that process, where it's like finding the smallest step I can take and then working out. Does that make sense? I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it totally does. And it sounds very similar sort of thought process and approach that I've seen work with others, and with myself as well. Because I think a lot of people still are in a position where they see mental game almost like a door or a barrier. And they're like, I'm going to break the barrier, or I'm going to open that door. And then suddenly I'm in utopia and everything is great. And it just doesn't work like that. It's exactly the same way as those journeys to physical training or improving our skills or our technique or our strategy, all these things. It's very much a long, drawn out process. And I don't know if you've found the same thing, in that and this is where like often like the self-compassion thing comes back, or just reflection, is that it also is something that you can have two steps forward and you can very easily have steps backwards. It's not just all in one direction. And when you have those steps backs, it's to go, actually, you know what? This is part of the process and it's very normal. And I've just got to think about, how does it make me feel? What is it? Why did it happen?
Yeah, it's normalizing that, right? Because I think so often people don't approach those types of things as things that they can work on. And so it feels really disempowering. Mm-hmm. You know, I can reference myself, but also people I see at the Crag who just say, well, if I went up on that, I would just get scared. So, you know, I'm not even going to try, because that's not, they think of it as an identity issue, you know, rather than something that they can work on. And so in that situation, it's like all those people who have somehow passed through that door you're talking about, like they've figured out the key and they unlocked it and then they're there. And everyone else who they see themselves as like, I didn't get there. Or if I did, I can easily like be booted back out the door. And then it's an issue with my identity or who I am, and not with the process that I'm taking. It's not because I took a month off. It's because I'm a scared human, you know, and that's a really interesting thing. I work with a lot of athletes that have been injured and they are coming back and they start getting physically stronger again, and they get on the wall and they feel like they've, you know, regressed in their mental game. Like they just can't commit, or they're feeling really timid. And the first step of that is always normalizing it for them. It's like, rather than saying, oh yeah, you're a problem because that's happening, it's saying, well, it makes total sense that you're scared. You just took a ground fall and your body remembers that. And so now you got to reteach your body that it's not going to take a ground fall every time that it falls, you know, but that's a process. It's not just like, oh, we switched a flip and now you're broken.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that it really struck a chord that where you said about like seeing it as your identity, and you see this where people, like in the same way that thing about where someone is trying to like quit smoking and someone offers a cigarette and one person will say, I'm trying to quit, and the other person will say, I'm not a smoker. And it's that difference between like a habit or a behavior versus your identity. And I've tried to flip it in my head. Like I was very much in the same position. I mean, I've still got some serious issues with like the whole mental game, especially with like heights and exposure stuff. But I try and flip it to, rather than I am just a scared climber, which I am quite scared, is more I try and identify with being a climber who gets scared easily, but I also identify with a climber who's prepared to get stuck in and challenge myself to get through that process each time, because I have to have that part. Because every single season when I go back to outdoors after training indoors, I'm just horrified of how bad I am. I mean, last season I was lying down on a 45 degree slab approach that you should be going in your trainers, because I couldn't get to the crag because the exposure was so bad. And I was going, I'm supposed to be a pro climber. And I was just beating down on myself so hard until I sat down there and went, wait a minute, no, you're a pro climber who struggles but is prepared to get stuck in.
Yeah. And I think that's so relatable, by the way, like getting stuck on an approach. You know, you mentioned Pat earlier, and there have been so many times, he's so compassionate. He's like such a sweet human. But there are so many times that he's like just romped up something, he turns around and he's like, Laura, you going to come up? I'm like, oh yeah, just psyching myself up, you know, just getting into that headspace. But I think that it's interesting. It's almost like you need those skills of being able to get stuck in, of being able to say, this isn't easy for me, and I'm still going to do it. Because people that maybe find that more naturally, I think are more likely to plateau, because they get to the point where that natural, you know, maybe they weren't scared in the beginning, but then all of a sudden they have to run something out on RPs and they don't have a process for it. You know, whereas if you're always working on it, if you're always leaning in, then that step of doing something that is a little bit more at edge is just one more step. So you're already used to leaning into those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's like a practiced thing, essentially, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it gets better over the years, even if it's always defaults to being something that's hard for you personally. You get better at getting involved with the process when you just practice it, not just 10 times, but 100 times, 1,000 times. And it will, I don't know if you agree, but for me, it's always uncomfortable. Always.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually interesting. This is relating back to the self-compassion piece, but I was mentioning, right, that was something that was hard for me. And so last year made a really concerted effort to practice it. And I always found, you know, a lot of self-compassion meditations will have you put your hand on your heart. And at the beginning, like the first 4 months, I was not into it. I was like, I'll put my hand on my shoulder, maybe, or like, maybe I'll like rub my palms together, but my hand is not touching my heart. That feels so hokey. And I noticed the other day I was having a hard conversation with someone, and I just noticed my hand naturally do this. And I was like, huh, you can teach yourself. Like you can find, you know, and I think falling's the same way, right? It's like you can learn how to ease yourself into a process, but you do have to be continually investing. It's not like, oh, I took 10 falls, so now I'll never be afraid again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's on the money. It's getting people to understand that it isn't just a switch where it's off and it goes away. Because I think a lot of people spend time in those first few instances of going through that process of getting to a better place with, you know, for example, falling, and it is uncomfortable and it's hard going through that, and they hope that the next time they're not going to have to do the same thing. But the reality is probably are, and
yeah,
it's gonna be the same again.
One of my favorite things, like especially if I'm working either one-on-one or in group setting with people, I try and make the falling fun enough that they're going to want to do it again. Like, so we take the stress down enough notches where everyone's laughing and having fun with it. And then it's like, that way they don't get to the gym the next time and feel like, oh no, like I have to do this again. You know, it makes it where it's something where we never pushed so far towards that kind of panic area that they didn't feel like they could come on back and start laughing and like enjoying the time that we were spending on the wall.
Mm.
Right. Cause falling is fun. Like once you're actually doing it, it's pretty cool that we get to do this sport where we fall through the air and then land in a soft, cushy rope and like bounce around. That actual action is pretty cool.
Yeah,
but there's so much hyped up around it.
Yeah, and it's also embedded to a greater degree in the culture of climbing, and it's bigged up in a big way. I sometimes wonder whether if the language around falling and whippers was, you know, softened a little bit, then maybe there wouldn't be such a big thing about it. I mean, there's a very macho culture around it when essentially it's part of the climbing process. Why does suddenly falling have to be macho? I don't think it needs to be. It seems odd when I think about it.
Yeah, it's almost like an opposite fear response. You know, like people that are, there's like ways that people respond to fear, right? And it's usually like rushing or stalling. And we think of people that are afraid of falling as people that are like stalling in the process. They're not willing to go and fall. But there's this whole other side of people that are afraid of falling that are rushing into the consequence. So it's like, well, if I can just get my biggest falls over with, if I can just like push it so far to the edge that there's no, yeah, it's almost like they're racing fear. They're trying to get ahead of it. And it's another fear response, right? But it's more socially acceptable, I think, for, especially for like masculine people to rush through fear rather than stall. It's like, kind of like a fight response.
Yeah. And I agree.
Yeah.
Can you sort of, I know you do this as your job and things like that, so you'll be very practiced in this kind of process, but can you talk us a little bit through your process for how you would deal with falls? So let's say, you know, you're working on a new route and it was one where the gear was, you know, a little bit smaller than we'd like, and the run out was a little bit further than you like. How does that look in a practical process for you on that route? How do you go for it?
Yeah, I can actually, maybe I'll just reference East Coast Fist Pump that I just worked on, because they're, so in the crux is like a green C3 and then a purple C3, and then you just go. Like it feels like you just go forever. It's probably 20 to 25 feet. And sorry for the feet. I'm trying to think of it.
No, we do feet. We do feet as well. But
perfect.
C3s are small, like passive protection pieces, aren't they?
They're active, but they're small. They're like the smallest cams. I think the purple is the second smallest that BD makes.
Okay, yeah.
So they're little, you know, and they're, but it was interesting for me. I found, so I'd place them, I'd be super stoked, like gunning up for the crux. And then there was a pretty committing move, like a big dead point at the point where my foot was at about that last piece of protection. So where I really felt like I was starting to feel that exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that I would like stop there and cry or like freak out, but I was kind of like slapping for it. I wasn't actually throwing for it. And I knew it wasn't a physical limitation. I knew I just was getting distracted by that piece. So I just, you know, I use the same process that I teach my students. The first thing I do is I'll take on the piece and I'll lower down enough that I can start bouncing around and I can actually get away from the wall.
Yeah.
And actually just swing on the rope like a little kid would, like pushing in and out of the wall. And part of that's to practice impacting the wall. But another part of that is that when we're having a fight or flight response, rhythmic movement and rhythmic breathing are going to calm it down. So if I'm in a fear response and I start pushing around and like, you know, doing that on the wall, I'm going to stop freaking out, basically. I'm going to regulate my nervous system. I'm going to start laughing and having fun again. So that's how I always start. Even, you know, that's like regardless of how I'm going to practice that day, I don't cheat myself on the impact drills because they're so fun.
Yep.
And then, so then I'll usually take a couple of files below the piece. And in something like that, where it's small and with a cam especially, I'm going to look and make sure that it doesn't move, right? Because there is a risk on with those pieces that they could come out, right? It's not like I'm totally stupid for being a little bit afraid there.
Yeah.
So I always go up and I'll take a couple small files on them and just make sure that they stay in position. And if they stay where they are, then I'll take one step up at a time into lead until I get to the point where I'm taking the fall where I would be, like I'll slap for that move and fall out of it. And sometimes I get, you know, I'll get two or three falls in and I'll feel so relaxed that I'm able to just go back up even though I didn't take the exact fall. And I can stay committed because I've regulated and I have enough falling experience in my background to rely on. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have to go take that fall three or four times at that height before I'm able to commit. So it just depends. But
and do you, once you've got beyond that dead point move and you've got the gear like a, you know, foot level or so, and I think this is a, you know, a familiar distance that a lot of people can relate to where the bolt or the gear is at foot level, maybe 1 to 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot below. Mm-hmm. What do you, how do you deal with it if you're on a route where we go to now like the, oh, the bolt or the gear is 20 foot below me? What's your, what's your process look like for that? I'm curious to see if it's similar to mine as well.
Yeah, that's a great question. Cause I think I make really clear decisions about my yes and no fall zones. So no fall doesn't mean necessarily like if I fall, I will deck and die, right? It just means that it's the zone where I know that if I got to a move where I didn't think that I could do it, that I wouldn't be able to commit to it, right? That committing to it would probably result in a fall that I didn't feel prepared to take.
Yeah.
I've fallen in my no fall zones before. You know, and usually it's fine. It's like, okay, cool. Like that worked. I'm glad it worked. But what happens is I make that commitment. Once I get past that zone that feels like it's a fall that I have experience taking, then I'm going to switch gears a little bit. I'm going to climb a lot more statically. I'm a lot more slowly and make sure that I'm doing every move with control. So there's no more giant dead point moves necessarily unless I have them rehearsed or they're so within my wheelhouse that I can do them.
Yeah.
You know, so at that point, like the top of East Coast, for instance, is probably about 12A and it's R rated. And it's like, once you get through that crux, you kind of flip that switch of, okay, I'm still on challenging climbing, but I know that if I breathe through this and I keep moving, there's a very low chance that I'll fall. As long as I stay kind of in my zone. Is that similar to your process?
So I'd say for me, I split it out to how hard the climbing is into those really long zones. So if it's climbing, which I feel like, so for example, like on East Coast, you're going from 514 climbing into 512 climbing. And I could be pretty sure that I'm well within the comfort zone, that I will revert back into that, you know, climb very, very steady, be really cautious, but more static, you know, your 100% style, almost like half soloing style.
Yeah.
And I won't do a lot of mental preparation or thinking about how I might deal with that really, really long fall.
Yeah.
But if it's much longer and I feel like the level of difficulty is climbing where I've got a high chance still of falling off, I have to go through the process of taking increasingly long lobs. Mm. And I hate it. Absolutely hate it. Sometimes I'm so bad, I'll put it off for days on the working of the process. But you know what? I have to get onto it at some point. Like when I was working on recovery drink, there's a long form that I just don't like at all. And some days I would just never even do it. And I just couldn't face, it just didn't feel right for the day. But every time when I went and eventually would take those increasingly long falls, which was more in my, I really don't want to fall because you had like one really small cam and then it was a long way to the next one. And I felt like that was already I didn't want to go too much further, was that it would be a case of getting accustomed to it and accepting that when I first did those very long falls, I was probably going to be so shaky afterwards, just chill out on the rope a bit, take in the exposure for maybe 10 minutes, maybe not even climb actually, and try and calm myself down in the climbing environment. Because I found that I had a better process when I try and calm myself down on the rope, on lead, rather than back down the belay. So rather than going, oh, I want to be in the belay, I don't like it up here, just get me out of here, I'm freaking out, it would be, Tom, learn to control yourself on lead up here where you don't like it. And again, that slowly worked with time, but I struggle with it like anything. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's with a lot of my athletes, I say like the one word that we're going to take out of your vocabulary or the one phrase is dirt me. You're like, we're just going to, because it's the reaction everyone has, right? It's defensive. It's you take a long fall or you don't do the move that you want or you blow your red point and you hit the rope and immediately you say, you know, get me out of here. I don't want to be here anymore. And that is one of the things that, you know, by the time you're on the ground, you're like, oh, shoot. I should have rehearsed that move, you know, before, or I should have taken that fall again, or I had an opportunity to learn how to feel safe and I didn't take it, you know? So being able, like you just said, to stay there and to calm yourself down and to show yourself that that environment can be an okay place to stay in, then you can go back up and do the work.
Yeah. And sometimes you'll surprise yourself and calm down over 10 minutes and go, oh, actually, I think I can go back and maybe repeat this a couple of times. Other times you won't. But if you give yourself that time to at least just process, it can surprise you on some of those days. And I found that when the days when it has come and the magic has sort of felt like it's all gone together, I've gone, whoa, Tom might even be the person that on some days he can deal with this. And then it sits in my brain and it goes, there's a little version of Tom sometimes that can do that. And it goes back into your identity and it feeds back into it.
Yeah. And it becomes, I think of it, it's a piece of identity, but it's also a resource. It's like you have this toolkit. It's almost like, you know, that's in there when you need it. Mm. And, you know, I struggle with the word identity because oftentimes with climbers, it can become, you know, we get this idea of identity being tied to outcome and not just sending, but also being able to take big falls, right? It's like, I'm a good person if I do, I'm a shitty person if I don't. So I always struggle with that idea of whether we're like building someone's identity or whether we're teaching them to kind of strip it down a little bit and make it a non-issue. But I think regardless, being able to have those resources is so important because then, like you said, the next time you're in that position, you can say, oh, I did that before. I have that voice inside of me that can come out when I need it.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree. Talking of identity, you've kind of hit the headlines recently as the first non-binary climber to climb 514, and I've obviously seen your post and seen some other stuff online, and I felt like that was something that was going to inevitably attract some attention and some friction. How's that been for you? Has it been okay? Has it been challenging?
I think it's been interesting. Like at first it was really challenging. You know, it's hard when people that don't know you are so mean. Like it's just so, you know, it's really confusing because I'm not a person that's gonna, you know, I didn't even know the first of all that headline was coming out. Not really. Like I knew that the person had interviewed me and we talked, but I didn't know that I thought it was just going to be some like little blurb on the side and Rock and Ice. It was like, oh, this random person climbed this route that's cool in Arizona, you know? And I didn't realize that they were going to headline it that way. And so obviously that drew a lot of attention that I wasn't expecting. And it's interesting because I've known about my identity for pretty much my entire life. I haven't always had the best words for it. And I felt like for a really long time that I had to hide it from other people in order to be safe. And I've done a lot of work not to feel that way. It's really triggering when I go into a situation like this where it's made really public and I see that side of people that made me afraid to show who I was. And I had to really, first of all, put my phone down. I had to put my phone down and kind of regulate and surround myself with people that I do feel safe with. But then also remind myself that they're being mean because they don't know me, you know, and they're being mean because they're being asked to think about this thing that's not actually tied to a human for them. So they're able to dehumanize me and they don't have to actually think about a person that they're hurting. They're just thinking about this concept that they don't have a person associated with.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I was really interested to see how that was for you, because when I first saw the headline, I was like wondering, was it basically something that was essentially, you know, used by the media to essentially pull traffic and things through because it's something that's more seen as interest or niche or provokes discussion? Or was it something that was more personal to Law, and Law said to Rocket Ice, you know what, I'd like to really say here, I want to create more spotlight on non-binary, you know, trans people who are climbing, and this is something that I'd like to do. And I was really curious to see how that was, because like I spend a lot of time in this social space. I'm on social media with like work accounts and my own personal accounts. And I think it's a tricky, like especially tricky zone to have been in for like the last, to me, it feels like the last year and a half. It's been very weird. And people have been very up and down. It's like, particularly, I think since the pandemic and things. And I thought that was really brave of you to just get involved with that. Cause I was like half put my head, and I read for you some of the comments. I was like, do I really want to do this? Cause I almost felt like I was going to be really angry for you. And I was like, should I do this? Do I need to do it? Is it a good idea? And then I was like, but I know Laura will be reading about this. I know that Mary will. I know that Pat, you know, like all of us as, you know, our kind of group and clan, especially of us as like trad climbers and crack climbers in the US, are just gonna get really hacked off about some of this. It's weird.
Yeah. It was interesting, you know, obviously. Like I can read all the comments. It's not like it, and I had people say like, oh, you shouldn't read them. I'm like, well, I could blow it up in my head as the worst things in the world, or I could just read what's there and deal with the reality of the situation. And for me, that was easier. But I did choose not to engage with anyone on there. You know, I mean, I wrote my own post, but I think that to a certain extent, people are looking for attention, right? So it's like, if I give them that, then it's just stoking that fire.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's, you know, I really, at first I felt mortified. I wanted to take the headline down. I was like, I don't want this out there. This is not what I'm going for. But I got so many messages from trans and non-binary people who said that it meant a lot to them to see someone like them in an article. And it meant a lot to them that I said it out loud, because the more that they can see me saying that and not being targeted, you know, even if I was targeted to a certain extent, but they see how many people are supportive, it makes them feel safer. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, you know, I spent maybe 16 years of my climbing life thinking that I would completely lose my community if I came out and if I talked about myself publicly about this thing that I can't control. You know, people think like they think of it as an expression or something, but it's really like it's a lived experience like anyone else's gender. And it's really confusing if you don't have words for it, or you don't see it around you. You just think you're a messed up human. So when I was able, so I just thought it was something I had to hide. And then being able to get to a point where I felt strong enough that I said, I can take this risk. I can talk about who I am openly. And if that makes everyone reject me and I lose everyone except for like a couple climbing partners, that's okay. You know, I'll still be safe in my body. That took a lot of work. And so I'd love to like get around that for other, you know, kids that are just wondering if people are going to love them still, you know, and if they can get that from an article, I can deal with a couple mean comments.
Yeah, it's a cool way to view that, that essentially some of the discomfort that you will feel will be to the benefit of others that may not have a voice yet in that public space. And essentially you're a representation of those quieter voices and people that have those, you know, levels of doubt or insecurity or just, you know, unknowns. And that helps that. I think that's a really cool way to also kind of help, I suppose, in a way, is it package it up so that you see it in a more positive, empowering light, because you go, I'm even doing something here by taking some of the stuff that comes back.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the word empowering, like, because positive, right? It's like positive can be tricky because it, you know, then I'm like, well, if it's positive, then I shouldn't feel sad about it still, right? Or I shouldn't feel angry. It's like, I can feel those and feel empowered to act. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't think, like, I don't want to put a rosy spin on it because it does hurt, right? Like last week, I had to reach out to some friends and say like, hey, I'm really triggered right now. I'm feeling really, you know, I'm really bummed about how this is going down. And I feel at a loss of how to interact with the community. And luckily I have amazing friends who responded back and like held me up, you know, and, but ultimately I decided not to, you know, take it down or to engage with people that were going to be hateful because of that sense of empowerment that I got from it. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was talking to one of the Lattice team earlier, Ian, who's a non-binary climber, and they were saying, "Oh, I'm so psyched that you're going to be interviewing Law." And I said to Ian, "Like, okay, is there any particular things that you would like me to like ask to Law in particular?" They are also a trad climber, mm-hmm. And done some quite tricky cracks as well.
Cool.
And Ian said, and it's maybe, it's, it, it, I guess I'm almost like a little bit nervous about asking it because that feels like a sensitive question, but Ian did say that they're interested, is that we've seen certainly in the UK here, a change in language that's occurred in climbing around some of the, like, what you would term sort of like cheating moves or good technique moves that have often been associated with gay homosexual language. And, you know, things around kind of use of heels or knees. So we even have a term that was used often, but and it is really phased out a lot in the last 10 years of that's a gay knee, for example. Have you seen a similar change in that language and that acceptability and that, that over in the, like on the other side, because, you know, we're quite different in some ways over in the UK, that's changed in the last 10 years, 5 years as well? And do you feel like it's got to go further?
Yeah, that's both. There's so much power in language, right? I think I've probably already accidentally nerded out when I say, oh, that word, I'm not sure if, you know, when we were talking about identity or even positivity. And I think the reason is because language really shapes our reality. Right. And so when I was in high school, it was really common to say if something wasn't cool, they'd say, oh, that's so gay.
Yeah. Same. Right? Okay.
Or, yeah. And like, I think there were a lot of other words that were used that, like, there was a lot of joking in the climbing community. We didn't have specific, maybe derogatory language for moves, but we had a lot of route names that were pretty discriminatory towards gay people or towards trans people. And we're starting to change those. But there's still so much pushback from people that say, you know, we have to respect the first ascensionists and we have to give them their say. And it really hurts as a person when your humanity is being targeted by a route name for someone to say, like, oh, but we have to consider the feelings of this first ascensionist. How will they feel if we rename their route? You know, it feels like, oh, we really care about that side, but we don't care about this side of dehumanizing. Because when we use that kind of language, we're saying it's okay to remove the person from the situation. And when you dehumanize someone, then it also becomes okay to hurt them, right? It's like, if someone's not really a human, then we don't have that same natural instinct to protect them. So I think that's the biggest thing I see with route names and just the way we're talking to each other in general. The reason that it has to change is because it's interwoven with this history of violence.
Mm. Yeah. And do you, where do you see the kind of, I suppose the, and I'll let you talk in particular for the sort of the US climbing scene, cause that's, you know, more local to you, but where do you see the sort of the main potentials for where the scene and the culture and for that change to occur around the, you know, the involvement with trans non-binary climbers in that scene? Where do you see it? Do you see it mainly on building of communities and like-minded individuals? Do you see it on education? Is it a blend of everything?
Yeah, I think it's both. You know, I think it does come back a little bit to that idea that, you know, in the US, outdoor culture originally was a lot around, you know, people going out and hunting, Boy Scouts, like a lot of these kinds of people, when you envision them, that are still associated with people who wouldn't likely be very accepting of LGBTQ people. So you saw a lot of people that did have an identity that they didn't think would be safe in the outdoors stay in city, in urban areas, right? Not really get into athletics or the outdoors because it wasn't an explicitly safe space. And climbing, you know, we like to pride ourselves in being kind of the outcasts and being really accepting. But there's not, without saying explicitly, you're going to be safe here, to a person that hasn't seen people like them be treated safely and has even seen violence towards people like them, there's going to be a reluctance to try, you know? And I think that's, we have more affinity spaces for queer people popping up in the US, and that's awesome. And part of the reason that's awesome is because people know that they'll be safe there, so it's a chance to try. And then beyond that, I think having leaders in the community who people can see themselves in, and also doing trainings for people to understand how to make their spaces safe. You know, gym environments also haven't always been traditionally safe places for queer people. There's a lot of showing your body. There's a lot of that kind of macho culture that maybe have, you know, people say things that are just kind of embedded in the culture, like you were saying, with the knee move. Is it like a knee bar?
A drop knee.
Yeah. So when people call drop, you know, and no, the person that's saying that, once it becomes a habit, they're not thinking, I'm trying to be violent towards this group of people. But to someone that is queer that hears that, it's going to sound like, oh, well, if they knew who I was, then they would not want me here. So I think it's a combination of doing training on how to create safe places and then creating like affinity spaces that feel safe for people to experience that it can be welcoming. And then also just setting expectations with people that even if they don't understand, it's not going to be okay for them to dehumanize or to be violent or to be you know, exclude people based on how they present.
Yeah, yeah. And talking of like kind of that same, you know, macho, I suppose macho culture or scene is that outside of the US, I think also to a big part in the media in the US as well, is that the trad climbing scene, and in particular as well for crack climbing, and you know, I'm really involved with both of those, is seen as a very macho thing. I think it's seen as quite often quite rednecky as well, particularly from outside of the US, and sometimes because of some of the, I suppose, the history left over from some of the earlier establishers of First Ascents and developing those areas. But I have found that being really involved in this scene over the last 5 years, that I think in the last 2-3 years, there is come about an absolutely amazing group of people. Like I think it's one of the best climbing communities that I have come across in all of my climbing years. I've been climbing like 20, I can't remember, longer, I think 24 years or something. And that group with, you know, people like you and Pat, Mary, Danny, Ashley, you know, Brittany, the crew that like they're hanging out in J-Tree, all these people that have come together in the last few years, I think it's really exciting and a very, very cool part of that climbing, ongoing and newly developing part of the climbing culture. And I think it's some of the most, interesting change that I've seen in climbing and groups of people that are making good connections compared to the last 24 years that I had in climbing. And that makes me really excited.
It's so awesome. Honestly, it's when I was describing those things that we can do, you know, one of the most powerful things is that if enough people come together and say, we're going to do things differently, then the culture is going to change.
Yeah.
And I think I've really seen that like in the last probably 5 years, like you said, in the US, in the Southwest, especially in that trad climbing scene, just so many people come in that would never have belonged in the trad climbing scene out here how it was 20 years ago, who just came in and found space and started just doing their sport and investing a lot in it and not really taking that bullshit of, oh, you don't belong here, or you have to be a certain type of person. It's like you belong because you're stoked on climbing and you're willing to fight really hard when you get on. And everyone's going to be stoked for you because that energy is contagious. And, you know, everyone that you mentioned in that scene, everyone I know here, we're really different people. You know, we have a really wide array of backgrounds. And it's been so fun to connect with everyone and get to know them because everyone's opted in to having a community where you don't have to assimilate. You get to... You belong because you're doing the thing together. And that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that for anyone like listening or watching now, and if they, you know, follow Law or any of us in this community that often will so post on in the public light, is I think it can sometimes come across as being, it gives the appearance of being quite airy-fairy and almost looks too good. And sounds like ultra accepting, like everyone's maybe trying to be really PC, but definitely take it from my experience of this and having come from, you know, being in climbing for a really long time, it is actually utterly genuine and remarkably special in what it is now. And I think all of you that are responsible for making this change and that are in that group over in the States, I would love to see like an ongoing lasting impact from what all of you are doing together, because I think it is something really unique and really special. And it's making sure that I always want to say like in these sort of things, like everyone, trust me, this isn't like some PR media thing. 100% is not. It genuinely is as good as it sounds when these people write. And when you go to the crags, make sure you go and talk to them and go and hang out with them, because you'll just leave the scene. Like, remember the last trip that I had to Joshua Tree? I walked away from that trip going, I think climbing is the best thing in my whole life. I don't know if I can even do anything anymore. Like, it was mad because it was such a good scene.
Yeah, it's infectious, right?
Yeah.
And I think of that difference between being PC versus being a community that's actually working together and creating safe space and accepting space.
Yeah.
Is, I think, maybe the best way to do it is using a Brené Brown quote, which is kind of hokey. But she always talks about that difference. And it's a social justice quote. It's about, like, there's a difference between wanting to be right and wanting to get it right. Right. And, like, being right, that means you're trying to, like, sidestep any tough conversations and, like, use all the right words and be, like, really, you know, just be, like, really woke. And wanting to get it right is, like, being willing to mess up, but letting the other person know that they're still a part of your community, that you care about them, and that you want to learn from them. You know, and I think, like, after East Coast, Brittany asked me, she's like, hey, this is probably going to be a weird conversation, but how do you feel about the whole, first non-binary ascent thing? You know, and we're just at the Crag hanging out, but we had a whole conversation about it. And she pushed me, and I kind of, like, and we really engaged in it, and it gave me space to talk about my experience. And she created that for me, right? Well, we're just out cragging. We're just having fun. But
yeah,
I never would have responded to a question like that 10 years ago. You know, I would have rather, like, run away from the Crag and never be seen there again kind of thing. And so it's cool to have a community where people are, like, there for the right reasons, and they're there to support each other. But it's not just like, oh, we're being hokey and PC. We're really, like, we've found something that we connect over, and we're going to invest in that connection a little bit deeper.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's well said with that. And I think also is that it's often seen to those that might struggle with some of these concepts and maybe have either grown up in a culture or a friendship group or, you know, just their industry, which struggles with some of these concepts and some of these terms, is that actually if you just get involved and start talking to people and just basically being a person, be human, be normal, yeah, and talk to people, it all works out so much better than you think, rather than always being back on the defensive and going, well, I don't want to engage with that, or I don't understand, or I don't like it.
Yeah.
Just be a person, chat to people, and it's okay to disagree as well. This is life.
Yeah. And I think people expect, like, especially with they, them pronouns, you know, people expect that I'm going to be really fragile about it.
Mm.
That somehow, like, they're like, oh, well, you shouldn't be so defensive. And I'm like, I'm just telling you the words I want you to use, but I'm actually really used to, like, people making mistakes, like, having tough conversations. And oftentimes it's the other person that's feeling really threatened because it's something they feel uncomfortable with. And I'm super willing, when people feel scared or uncertain, to have those conversations. But I think so often people get almost angry because they feel like it's a threat to their own identity. And I don't want it to seem like something where I'm being really fragile or really precious about who, it's like, I know my pronouns, I know who I am.
Mm.
And I want to share that with people because it makes it easier for me to go through my life and not have to always be hiding or compartmentalizing. But I don't expect them to know what my whole life is, the same way that I don't know all of the things that make them a human, you know? And so I think if people felt a little more comfortable with dialogue and they didn't feel as concerned with being perfect already, it'd be easier to have those conversations more often.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it is okay to make mistakes. I make mistakes with it all the time. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I had to, like, check myself when I was talking about Ian earlier on. And immediately, like, make a mistake, even though I work with Ian at work all the time, and I'm aware and I know what in my head I want to do, but I'm, like, constantly in an automation zone where you swap between, but I've never had a response from Ian ever at work where, you know, they've been really upset that I've got something wrong in an instant. It just isn't how it is.
Yeah, most of the time, a non-binary person isn't going to say anything because they don't want to make a scene. If they really trust you, they'll probably correct you. Mm. And they'll be super chill about it, right? Like, I think of, like, my boss at work, I care about him so much. And I know, and 80% of the time, he uses my correct pronouns. And on that 20%, every once in a while, I'll be like, oh, hey, it's they. You know, and it's just super chill. And he's like, oh, thank you. You know, and it's we just move on. And I only correct him because I really trust him. And I want to feel connected to him. And so it matters to me that I say something to him, and it's about our relationship. It's not really even about just me. Mm-hmm. If it's about just me, most of the time I just like go with whatever someone says, because it feels scary to correct someone if you're used to people getting defensive about it.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Let's talk 2021 and trad climbing and cracks and all things, you know, gnarly and trad-like. Go on, just first off, like, because I'm always curious, what's on your radar? What you got a plan for? Is there any projects in the line for Sense?
There's, so a little bit of it depends on what kind of travel I'm able to do, but I put off going to Moab last spring and just stayed super local in Flagstaff. I actually bouldered all spring, which was awesome and something I've never done before. And so this year I'm really stoked to go back to Moab. It's not far from me. It's like 4 hours.
You're Flagstaff, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So hoping to spend most of my spring there. And I've got some things. I still never got to get back on the belly. I just tried that a couple years ago and then it wasn't able to go back last year. So I'd like to get back on Belly Full of Bad Berries and Conception for sure. Those are both so rad. There's a couple other things that I'd like to check out, but I feel like since I haven't been on them, I don't know if I want to like fully say that they're actual, like it's nice to try a route first before you know whether it's a goal route or not.
Yeah, yeah. Because then you know, you add up the pressure and then totally. Yeah. Well, can I persuade you down to the White Rim at all?
I really want to go down to the White Rim.
Have you ever been before?
Never. No.
Oh, you haven't.
I'm so excited. That was the plan for this past spring as well. We even had a permit already, but
yeah, for anyone listening or watching who's not aware of where the White Rim is, it's, or what it is, it's basically what I would consider the number one mecca for hard roof crack climbing, probably in the whole world. It's basically like Engine Creek, but turn it horizontal and just loads of hardcore horizontal roof cracks of all different sizes, isn't it?
It's pretty amazing, yeah. It's funny, when I was pretty young, I used to go down to the Red River Gorge for weekend trips because I lived in Michigan. It was about 7 hours away. And it was the closest climbing that we had. So when we would go, we would make these lists of routes that were about 100 routes long for our weekend. Be like, we're going to do all of these routes this weekend. And we never actually did all 100, but we would just rally all weekend long, like running between crags, trying to get as much climbing in. I don't think I've totally outgrown that, because when I look at my list of routes I want to climb on in Moab, it's like, okay, every single route at the White Rim, in addition to these like 15 other routes that are in the Moab area. It'd be awesome to just go and like get on a bunch of things and figure out which ones feel realistic for the season. And then there's which ones are going to be.
Yeah, there's so many good things down there. And you do well down there because you've done some of this invert style thing, these things, and you've got all the crack repertoire basically at your disposal. You know,
I love horizontal cracks. They're my very favorite.
They're really good. And they're such good lines as well. Like they all look absolutely killer. I mean, you stand at the base of them and you look at this massive roof and you think, well, there's no way I'd be climbing that on face holds, but I definitely can climb that if it's a crack.
Yeah, no, I'm so excited. I know Mary's been working on Necronomicon. Mm. And so, you know, oftentimes too, some of what I climb on depends on who's psyched on what, you know, because it's always more fun to climb with someone who's psyched on the same thing.
Yeah.
So I bet I can convince her to get back out there.
Yeah. What's your hand size like?
I have a really interesting hand size because my fist is about the same size as my cupped hands. So my hand size can go in like ones and twos, like reds and yellows. But I can do thin hands, like thin hands aren't too hard for me. I've done a lot of stuff with 0.75, so I don't have to ring, like can kind of like work my thumb jam in there. So that works pretty well.
Paddle hand.
Yeah. Is that what you call it?
Yeah. We call it the paddle okay. hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, I've been going on about this for a while with Pete, that we reckon that the paddle hand is essentially the half crimp of crack training that
like
years ago, everyone used to use basically open forefinger grip position and full in climbing. And then people realized that half crimp training was really effective for face climbing. And it feels like the paddle hand is the thing that's going to connect up the dots with crack climbing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that all systems go route in Sedona. I think I sent you a picture of it at one point. It's like probably 30 to 45 degrees overhanging paddle hands. It's amazing. It's really cool.
I'm going there. I'm
yeah.
As soon as this quarantine's over, I mean, not quarantine, I mean, lockdown, I need to get there. I need to go and do mechanical bull as well.
Yeah, you need to do the ball and all systems go, and then Lifeline and Red Planet, obviously. So there's enough to come here for.
Yeah. Oh man, one of these days when, you know, all this stuff is over and everything like that. I've taken up probably quite a lot of your day so far, and I know you're gonna, you know, need to get off to work and things like that. So I won't take up any more of your precious time, but I would be great to just leave everyone with just some knowledge on where they can find you to do any work with you as a mental training coach, and kind of best links to be able to pursue any of that, because I think anyone watching or listening will have quickly grasped from this interview that Laura is a pretty amazing person, and I would fully, fully back them to work with you if you're going to start to work on any of the mental training game.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate that. And I think the best place to reach me professionally is through the Rock Warriors Way. So it's just warriorsway.com. And we have all of our training offerings on there. We're doing a little bit of in-person training outside again, which is exciting. But I also work with a lot of athletes remotely, and that's all on there. And then individually, the best way to reach me is probably on social media. It's just my name, Laura Sabrin, on Facebook and on Instagram.
And is that spelled LOR_SABOURIN?
Yes. Oh. That was amazing.
I can't believe I spelled it right.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, those are great ways to get in touch with me. I'm pretty responsive to my DMs. And I also, when people go on the Warriors Way site, it pretty much goes directly to me. So.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for that. Totally awesome.